tight from within. You're about to go behind enemy lines.
Roger, 3-2. Goliath copies all. Go ahead.
Target is surrounded by multiple firms entering what appears to be a residential area. Requesting permission to engage.
From the People's Republic of New York City, you're now going behind enemy lines with Gene Berardelli and Russ Gallo.
Enemy lines. Hey there, how you doing, America? Gene Berardelli here with you. So glad you can be with us, whether you're joining us at www.behindenemylinesradio.us or if you're checking us out on AM radio, FM radio, the internet radio. We're glad that you're tuned in, locked and loaded with us, or if we're traveling along with you as a podcast, we're happy to be along for the ride. Got a great show for you this week. We're going to fly solo, or not really, actually, because we're going to have on the debut of BEL contributor Nat Paul. Great young kid with a great story to tell. Going to talk a little bit of wonky stuff, talking about the Electoral College and reform and a great series of articles that he did for the radio show, website, I should say, and then he brings it on to the radio show. That's really cool. But before we get to the wonk, and before we get to all the fun stuff, of course we want to say happy Thanksgiving to everybody out there. Hope your holiday is full of family, food, and fun. And there aren't too many arguments at the dinner table over either politics or religion or anything else. Hope it's just mostly bad uncle jokes and things like that. And allow us to be your political talk for the week so that you don't have to do it at the dinner table. Put the knives down. Don't attack your crazy uncle or, you know, your mom or your sister or your cousin about politics just because they think differently than you. Let's do all the political talk here. And what we're going to talk about, quite a few different things. Like I said, we're going to talk about the wonk later on, about the Electoral College and things like that with, you know, voting and stuff. But right now, let's get to something juicy. I'm in the mood for the juicy bits of politics, the palace intrigue, the salacious stuff. And in this case, we're going to talk about, shockingly, the Democrats, who are sending a whole new crop to Capitol Hill next year. And already the cracks are starting to form. And what we're seeing is a bit of a revolt against presumed next speaker, Nancy Pelosi. I say presumed only because it may not be etched in stone, folks. A letter was sent, signed by, I believe it's 16 members of the Democratic congressional delegation, all stating that they can't support Nancy Pelosi as the speaker and that they're going to be voting for someone else because voters voted for change in this election. They didn't vote for the old Democrat machine, the old white Democrat machine. And you'll see why I'm bringing race into it in a second, folks. They think that Nancy Pelosi should be pushed out. She's had her time. Her time is up. Someone else's time is now. And you're seeing that from many on the left. Interestingly enough, not from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because she feels that the makeup of the people who signed this letter, again, are old and white, and who are not representative of the diversity of the Democratic Party, and they feel like they're just taking advantage. So she hasn't joined in this. Oh, no, no, no. You know, she'll be mistaken for an intern, and she'll have her outfits talked about. But when it comes to taking a stand against Nancy Pelosi, she's not going to take a stand with these people because they're white and they're old. Not me bringing race into it, folks. It's the Democrats bringing race into it, as they always seem to do whenever there is dissension in the ranks. Now, what are the chances of Nancy Pelosi not being the next speaker? I gotta think it's slim to none. And the reason why is the almighty dollar, folks. Say what you want about Nancy Pelosi. She's bots. She's crazy. She's a freaky loo wackadoo on the left or whatever. You know, she's out of touch reality. But one thing she is not out of touch with, and you have to give her credit for this, begrudgingly if you're a conservative, she has the money. She is able to raise money. She is able to generate revenue for Democrats and their campaigns. So if you are turning your back on Nancy Pelosi, you're turning your back on a whole heap of money, a whole pile of it. So that's why I think a lot of people, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, are not ready to throw Nancy out with the bathwater. It's not going to happen, folks, because the buck still runs politics. The money still runs politics. The cheddar still runs politics, no matter what side of the aisle you are on. But what will happen in this battle, in my opinion, is the politics of divisiveness will continue. You're still going to see people segmenting out groups, especially leadership and Democrats. You're going to see them segmenting out groups. Women, ethnicity, sexual orientation. Those are just the start. We're already seeing the cracks of what I guess would be a coalition of quote-unquote diversity breaking down, because now even the divisions have divisions. The latest sign of that for me is what's happening with organizers of the Women's March. Full disclosure, I have a regular friendly dialogue with Linda Sarsour. I know that people don't like that. A lot of my friends don't like that. We keep it light and breezy and talk about, you know, Brooklyn and family and things like that. I have no problem with talking to somebody on the other side. You don't demonize your adversary. You engage your adversary and you show them for what they think and what they believe. Sometimes that's good. Sometimes it's bad. In this particular case, what we're seeing with the Women's March is that they're getting all shook up by news coming from one of their own. What happened was an organizer of the Women's March, a woman by the name of Teresa Shook, who is now her role is being downplayed by organizers of the Women's March. This woman is coming out and calling for Women's March leaders to resign. Wants those activists out. Linda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory, and others. And why is that? Well, for the same reason that Alyssa Milano has decided that she's not going to speak at the next Women's March, because of alleged anti-Semitic and anti-gay statements made by Mallory, Sarsour, and others. Now, I am far from the person who's going to call anyone a bigot, anti-Semite, or anything like that. I don't know these people. I can see their actions outwardly, but I don't know what's in their heart. And you know what? At the end of the day, that's all that matters when you're talking about whether or not someone is a bigot or not. Donald Trump gets called a bigot all the time. And no one knows what's in his heart. No one knows how he is. This is a tactic of the left. I refuse to engage in that. Teresa Shook, who I presumably, again, someone I don't know. I don't even really know Linda Sarsour. And I don't really think that anyone can say that they know her, at least on the right anyway, that they know what's in her heart. They can only know by what her statements are and what the indications are. But Teresa Shook seems to believe that the founders of the Women's March, or I guess her co-founders, they are acting and supporting anti-Semitism and anti-gay rhetoric because they support the minister, and I use that term lightly, Louis Farrakhan. Now, there's someone who we know what's in his heart. We know that he is racist and bigoted. We know what we're dealing with when we're talking about him. But the reason why they're saying that Sarzor and Mallory and all these people should be resigning is because they have not denounced statements by Mr. Farrakhan. I'm not going to use the word minister because I don't believe that he's a minister. He's a hate monger, in my opinion. And they, because they did not outwardly reject those anti-Semitic statements, and because they did not reject those anti-LBGTQ, LMNOP, whatever it is these days, statements, that therefore you are no longer fit to lead this movement. Now, predictably, of course, this has caused a firestorm by the Women's March leadership. Statements have been sent out left and right about how dare this person say anything about this, about this situation, because guess what? She's not a person of color. How dare she say she didn't have anything to do with this? She is not an organizer of the women's, but she started a Facebook group, according to statements that I've seen on the internet. And I'm not going to attribute them because they're from private Facebook pages and whatnot. They're saying that they don't need to apologize for their statements. At least there's no outward apology. They're saying, of course, we're not anti-Semitic. Of course, we're not anti-gay. I am not these things. But they're saying that without rejecting Minister Farrakhan for one reason or another. So this is causing a split. And one of the statements that I saw from Linda Sarzor was saying that Teresa Shook is a white woman masquerading. Let me get the quote exactly right so I don't misquote people here. There was a statement made that, here it is right here on FoxNews.com. Folks who masquerade as progressives but always choose their allegiance to Israel. That's one statement that's being referred to as an anti-Semitic statement, basically saying that Jewish people are two-faced. But there was a statement made in response to Shook, which I'm going to be looking for right now, where she actually is, deriding the fact that this Teresa Shook, A, didn't do anything for the Women's March, and that basically she was not a real organizer of it, and that, and also makes allusions to her ethnicity, the fact that Teresa Shook is white, and that therefore she needs to take several seats. Again, I don't think that this has to do with anything when it comes to who's in charge of what with a march about empowering women. I don't see how race comes into it. If you're empowering women, it should be empowering women of every race, every culture, every religion, every background, every political opinion. Everyone needs to be empowered, and they need to have their voices heard. I don't see why some women are more equal than other women. I think that's kind of the point I'm trying to get to here. Maybe I'm wrong here. I don't think that there is an inherent weight that should be given to someone's opinion just because of who they are. It should be because of what they know. It should be because they have an opinion on something, and if they can back it up with factual assertions or empirical evidence that, or even anecdotal evidence, should be listened to. I don't get this whole idea that just because I'm an Italian male from Brooklyn, New York, that my opinion on certain issues are less valid than some other person of a different background, different gender, different race, different ethnicity, different religion, different social strata, different economic strata. We all have opinions. We all have a voice here. And the voices should be equally respected, not one valued over another. And again, this is something that I think Democrats will be exploring as they have this new leadership coming in to Congress next year, and it's going to be interesting to see whether they coalesce and come together as one big happy Democratic family under unified leadership, or if they fracture off into what we've seen on the right, establishment versus insurgent, progressives trying to come into the mainstream of the party. And where is the mainstream of the party going to be when this is all said and done? It's going to be very interesting to see if this little tiff in the women's march is, you know, emblematic of what we're seeing in the party as a whole. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking about a few more topics here. We're going to wrap up what happened in Florida and Georgia. And then later on, we're going to be talking about Electoral College reform with our own Nat Paul. Gene Berardelli behind enemy lines. We'll be back right after these brief words.
Behind enemy lines.
Open calendar. What's my schedule looking like?
Next Thursday, you will be caught in an emergency flash flood between Park and First Street.
What? No, that doesn't work. I'm busy then. Decline. Decline.
Floods don't exactly work around your schedule. Disasters don't plan ahead. But you can. It starts with talking to your loved ones about making an emergency plan. So don't wait. Communicate. Get started today at ready.gov/plan. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
If you're a longtime listener of the show, or maybe this is your first time listening, you can probably tell that me and the gang here, we like to have our share of fun, whether it's on or off the air. We talk about two-drink minimum radio and no medication Wednesdays or whatever day it may be. That's why when we found the people at Less Government More Fun, we knew it was a match made in heaven with this show. Folks, we live in a time where government is out of hand. Our founding fathers did not intend government to be all-consuming in all parts of our lives. That's why we are telling you to go to lessgovmorefun.com, check out the website, check out the swag. What the people want is less government, more fun. Pass it on, make it happen. Behind Enemy Lines Radio is all about being right. No, seriously, it is. If you ever listen to Russ Gallo or me go back and forth on some issue, we always want to make sure that we remember who said what and when we said it. That's why we go to GoOnRecord.com. It's a brand new social media website. Challenge people on what they believe, whether it's in politics, sports, entertainment, finance, whatever. There's a category for you at GoOnRecord.com. Check it out right now. Tell us, what do you stand for? It's time for you to go on record.
Behind Enemy Lines. Back on the air.
Gene Berardelli, back behind enemy lines. Time to do the plugs here, folks, before we get back into the show. Thanks for listening to Behind Enemy Lines Radio. I'm Gene. Russell will be back next week when he gets back from his National Guard drill. Hope you're safe and sound, good buddy. Hope you got to blow up a lot of good things. Check us out at www.behindenemylinesradio.us. Check us out on the Facebooks and the Twitters at BEL_radio. And if you missed any part of the show, no matter how you're listening to it, don't worry, it's cool. There are tons of ways you can listen. You can always check us out on our on-air rebroadcast outlets, including WJHC, Talk 107.5 FM in Jasper, Florida, Talk 92.1 FM, WDDQ in Adele, Georgia, and News Talk 1330 AM, WLBB in Carrollton, Georgia, all a part of the Talk America Radio Network, powered by ICRN, the Internet's Conservative Radio Network. You can also check us out at KLRN Radio and Lone Star Talk Radio, Sackheads Media. You can check us out at Lanterns.buzz and Lanterns Radio, Eye to Eye Talk Radio, and our newest affiliate, Mojo 50 Radio, a project of our friend Ron Phillips and Doc Thompson and Matt Locke and a lot of great people over there that are really building a powerhouse of conservative programming. Check them out at Mojo50.com. But if you miss any part of the reprocast, that's cool too. Listen, you don't have to listen to us live or live on tape or live broadcast or whatever we do. You can always check us out on demand. We're available to you anytime you want us around. We're available on Spreaker, Stitcher, Podbay, Player FM, TuneIn. You can discover us on Google Play Music. Find us on SoundCloud. You can also get us, of course, on iTunes and the mighty, mighty iHeart Radio Network. We're in the podcast section. Check us out there. Got a lot of show left to talk about. Nat Paul's going to be on later talking about the Electoral College and his three-part series that he wrote for www.behindenemylinesradio.us. But I'm still looking for juicy stuff to talk about, especially because it's Buffoon of the Year season, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to be talking a whole lot of buffoonery this year because, oh my goodness, the nominees are just pouring in for us to sort out to a top 16. We got that selection show coming up quite soon. Who knows? It might even be next week. I got to check the calendar to see if we're actually doing it next week or the week after. But it's going to be a barn burner. And the person who I think is the number one seed right now, Michael Avenatti, is in the news again this week. And this time because his girlfriend, this actress, I don't even know her name. It's like Mirella Minuti or something like that. I don't even know how to pronounce it. As I, you know, mispronounce names all the time. You know that. Well, anyway, Avenatti has got a restraining order against him now. By this woman who doesn't want him anywhere near her. And it was granted this week. And listen, it's starting to look more and more like Avenatti should believe women. As much as I'm having fun saying this, it appears that Michael Avenatti is looking for due process and a presumption of innocence and is looking for us to disbelieve this woman who's going to be the accuser in court. And these are all the things that he was seeking to deny Judge Kavanaugh during the Kavanaugh hearings when he was representing Judy Swetnick. By the way, where is Miss Swetnick lately? Has anybody seen her in the news? I mean, she did accuse Judge Kavanaugh of being part of, like, rape gangs and going to multiple parties where these trains would happen. But yet, since Judge Kavanaugh has been appointed, we haven't really heard from her so much. Maybe it's because both her and Avenatti were referred by Chairman Chuck Grassley of the Senate Judiciary Committee to be referred to the FBI for investigation about possible false allegations against Judge Kavanaugh, now Justice Kavanaugh. Maybe that has something to do with it. But this just piles on to the really, really bad week that Michael Avenatti had. It's turning into a bad month between the multi-million dollar judgment that a former associate has won against him and his law firm, and being evicted from his Newport Beach law office. And now this domestic violence beef with restraining order. Things are not going so smoothly for the would-be next president of the United States. And I say that laughing again because I can't say that with a straight face. No one should be taking this guy seriously. The guy's clown shoes, bottom line. But he's going to be in the running for Buffoon of the Year. I can almost guarantee that. And along with so many other deserving buffoons, including one that also made the news this week, Brenda Snipes may be in the running for Buffoon of the Year just because she screwed up the Florida election so bad with a now Governor-elect DeSantis and Senator-elect Scott finally being declared the winners in those races. Thanks, Brenda, for all the entertainment that you provided us for Buffoon of the Year purposes, being a last-minute entry, for finding all these votes that apparently popped up out of nowhere and then, you know, not really having a good explanation about it or missing every single judicially mandated and legally mandated deadline for counting votes, you know, for forgetting to carry the one and all that stuff. It just seems like, wow, we got so many buffoons this year. It's going to be a blast choosing between them. And I can't wait to bring this election show to you guys. It really is the most wonderful time of year. And not just because of Christmas season coming. It's because Buffoon of the Year season is coming. And we love that on the show. The other thing I want to talk about real quick before, you know, I'm up against a hard break here. We have an epidemic in this country of not accepting election results. It started with Hillary Clinton accusing Donald Trump of wanting to do this. But now Stacey Abrams in Georgia, part of our listening area, is saying that while she is acknowledging the results of the election of now Governor-elect Kemp, that she is saying that this was not a legitimate election, that there was fraud, there was suppression. Listen, folks, 50,000 votes plus is now the margin of victory for the governor-elect. I don't see how there can be that much fraud and suppression without evidence of it that could be actually examined by a neutral fact finder. It just is impossible. But this epidemic on the left of delegitimizing election after election that they don't like the outcome of, it is so counter to our democracy and to our founding principles. It's a situation that really was not conceivable just a few short years ago. We brought this up last week when Al Gore had one of the closest elections in our nation's history. He respected the rule of law and he conceded properly and he actually brought a healing to the nation together. Hillary Clinton and these new breed of Democrats are simply doing the opposite. They are engendering fear, disenfranchisement, and resentment in the country, and that's not good going forward in this nation. It's gotten to the point, folks, where you have to question the qualifications of some of these people that are quote-unquote leaders out there, right? Hillary Clinton going around, you know, delegitimizing the Trump presidency has had a very dilatory effect on, you know, pushing forth the agenda that people elected him for. And going later on in the show, we're going to be talking about a product of that, which is Nat Paul's running story about Electoral College reform. The reason why he even wrote that is because of this feeling of resentment towards election results and going after, quote, the system and claiming the system is bad. Just as a little preview of my opinion for Nat's articles, and you'll probably hear it in the interview. It's a great discussion we have, by the way. We don't agree on the Electoral College at all. I think the Electoral College is doing exactly what it should be doing, and that is striking this balance of federalism between popular vote and one person, one vote, and populations of each state and making sure that states have their say in what happens in these elections. I feel like it strikes that balance really well. If you wanted to break it down to one person, one vote, obviously campaigns would change their strategies and, you know, target different areas and different voters. They would go into the people, you know, Republicans would go into the People's Republic of New York. Democrats would go into Texas. And they would find these voters in different pockets and try to steal them here and there to kind of tip the balance. But it should also be, in my opinion, the Electoral College preserves the union. States are what is very important in our Constitution. States are the laboratories of democracy. States determine how their electoral votes are actually distributed, whether it be winner take all or if it's proportional, as some states have chosen. They can choose to do that within the constitutional framework of the Electoral College. We'll also be getting into this whole, at least briefly, the multi-state compact that's been going around where states are going to be making this extra constitutional remedy to not being able to amend the Constitution and the Electoral College and how it operates. To me, that's just the wrong thing to do. We'll explain that fully during the show, but I don't think that states should be pledging themselves in accordance with what other states will be doing as to how their votes will be determined, especially in a compact that could be revocable pretty much at any time. There needs to be a permanence in your voting system. We're going to get into that as well. We also talk about what happened in Maine with this ranked voting nonsense. There's a whole lot of show coming at you, folks. Can't wait to bring it to you. But we got to take a quick break right now. When we come back, Nat Paul comes on the show to discuss those articles and these very issues. Gene Berardelli, behind enemy lines, getting a little choked up here. That means we'll be back right after a few brief words from some sponsors and friends.
Hey folks, I just want to let you know about a great opportunity for listeners of Behind Enemy Lines Radio. If you go to our website, www.behindenemylinesradio.us, and click on the same box ad on the right side of the page, you will get a great opportunity for a discounted offer to join Sanebox. Sanebox filters out all the unimportant email from your inbox so that you can really focus on what matters. If you're anything like me, folks, you get hundreds of pieces of email a day, not many of which is important. Sandbox's smart filter will get everything you need to fly through your inbox and finally make email work for you. It gets rid of spam emails, it deprioritizes emails that aren't as important to you, and it helps you unsubscribe from mailing lists and individual senders with ease. So again, go to www.behindenemylinesradio.us and you click on the Sandbox ad and you'll be given an exclusive offer you won't find anywhere else. Gene Berardelli, back behind enemy lines. We are way past overdue in introducing you to one of our great contributors at www.behindenemylinesradio.us. It's really my fault for kind of hoarding him to myself because he writes such great wonky stuff. And you know what? It's time we should get a little wonky. The last thing we want to do on Thanksgiving is talk politics. So let's get it all out here with our very own contributor, Nat Paul. Nat, how you doing, sir?
Oh, I'm doing great, Gene.
Well, listen, you've been busy. And, listen, first of all, it's great to have you on. We got to get you on more often. You've been busy with your not-so-brief history of the Electoral College. It's a three-part series that we did on the website. And again, I'll say it again, www.behindenemylinesradio.us. Can't say that enough on the show. And it really is quite an interesting look and an interesting primer, really, for those who don't know too much about the Electoral College. What made you decide to do this?
I see a lot of people that have strong opinions about the Electoral College without really knowing a whole lot of specifics. I feel like it gets glossed over in school and never revisited for most of us. And so I was hoping that by writing a piece and getting people to read it, maybe they would understand it better and perhaps it would change their opinions. Perhaps not, but it helps you back them up anyway.
Well, the one thing I like about what you write, and when we say this here on Behind Enemy Lines all the time, we are not fair and balanced. We're not looking to give, you know, just the facts, ma'am. We have definite opinions. And sometimes those definite opinions don't coalesce together. I mean, I've read a lot of what you put out here. And while, you know, I believe it is a good primer, like I said, you have some definite opinions here that I want to talk to you about. So you ready to do this? You got your big boy pants on for this or what?
Let's do it.
All right. So I got the sense from reading all three of your articles on the website that you're not a fan of the Electoral College as it is. Basically, you understand why it exists, but you don't understand why it hasn't changed with the times. Am I mischaracterizing you, or do you think you could say it better?
It sums up pretty well, I think.
Okay. So now, what do you feel currently is wrong with the Electoral College?
I think one problem that we face is that it's not always the most accurate representation of the voters. And I think it also, because of the way it's set up, I think it disenfranchises the voters in a lot of states who stay home because they know that their preferred candidate has no chance of winning that state.
Okay, so let's unpack those two. Because I think I half agree with what the two things you said. The first thing you said, that it's not representative of the voting population. Now, you're talking about the voting population as a whole nationally, or the voting population of that particular state? Because I think you recognize there is a difference between those two, right?
Right. And I think it's a bit of both.
Okay. So
we have decided by plurality in most states, or, you know, in most states it ends up being a majority, but there were about 10 or 12 this last time where neither candidate had a majority and still got all the votes.
Right. And you know, I think the states where Jill Stein had the margin of victory, because there were more than one candidate available. More than two candidates, I should say, available, more than the two parties that are normally talked about. There were third-party candidates like Jill Stein who ended up getting more votes than what the margin of victory was, and thus there was a plurality in those states. But what is wrong with a plurality? It's still, you know, the top person wins, right?
Well, the top person wins, but that might also mean that the most unpopular candidate also wins if that candidate's detractors all voted for separate people.
Right, but what do you do to fix that quagmire, though? Because you can say that about any candidate in that race. You could say that, you know, the top vote getter, quote unquote, didn't win, but neither did anybody else. So why shouldn't it just go to the top vote getter? Why does it have to be that 50 plus one in your mind?
It demonstrates better consensus
And you know what? That may be true.
There's a certain legitimacy to it to have a majority, I think.
You know what? That may be true that it's a demonstration of consensus, but if there is no consensus, even if there's just a plurality, why shouldn't the top vote-getter get those electoral votes? If that's the way that, you know, their state has determined their electoral votes will be distributed, why is that a problem when there are multiple candidates that are earning votes? You're never going to get to a 50-plus-1 situation.
Gene, there are definitely ways around that. Like, Maine just adopted a ranked choice system where if nobody gets a majority consensus, then they start knocking people off the bottom of the ballot and giving those votes to whoever those people voted second for. They're number two preference.
There is something, I know, and you brought that up in part three, and I gotta say, I don't feel that that's very democratic at all either, because now you're shifting vote counts where someone who was a third-ranked candidate ends up winning. And the person that got the most first-place votes doesn't win. You know, it sounds a lot like, you know, the Cy Young. The Cy Young has first-place votes, second-place votes, and third-place votes. But the one who gets the first-place votes have majority, those are weighted more than the second-place votes. And those are weighted more than the third-place votes. Why should a third-rate candidate who doesn't get all the first ballot positions in that ranked election be able to win then?
Like, this way, there's still definitely flaws to it. It's not neat. It takes a while to count it all up. And it's possible that a lot of people are still going to be pretty unhappy, especially if their guy was in first place. And then the lower choices, I think it just happened actually in Maine. The Republican was winning through the first round of the tally. And then the Democrat was more people's second and third choice and scooted just past.
Right. I mean, absolutely. That happens.
It sucks to have your guy winning and then not. Usually come from behind victories are more fun in baseball than in politics, for sure.
Oh, no, absolutely. But now we're talking about the presidency.
Well, for the presidency, it's a similar deal. It's definitely not fun to have your presidential candidate winning and then not. But when we're so divided that there's not a clear consensus, it seems more fair to either proportionately divvy out the electoral votes or to go ahead and use like a ranked choice system or something like that to make sure that everyone's voice is actually heard.
Well,
I think that this could lead to actually a higher rate of voter participation.
Well, I think what 2018 has taught us, though, at least in my opinion, and Nat, I totally respect your opinion on this, and I get what you're saying. I feel like what gets people out to vote is a reason to go out to vote. And if people start seeing, in let's say in Maine, in a ranked voting system, that the number one choice, the person who got the number one choice overall isn't winning, then that disenfranchises just as much. I mean, again, one man's opinion. And to me, it feels like the Electoral College system, you know, getting kind of back to the topic, the Electoral College system to me feels like the balance of federalism. You have popular voice and you have substantive weight of population by state as broken down by congressional district. Now, one point I'll give you credit for that you brought up in your articles is that some congressional districts are not as equal as others. Why don't you give the example that you gave in part three about Wyoming?
You point out that Wyoming has a whopping total of, darn, I forget how many people.
Somewhere around, you know, the population.
4 million?
It was about 200,000 in the congressional district. Not exactly the most populous state in the union.
Right.
And yet.
And so they're.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So their voice proportionally far outweighs their population. Whereas you look at a large state like Texas or California, they have many more people per electoral vote, and so their votes don't count equally.
Right. So, for instance,
and I understand definitely wanting to to weight things a bit so that the tiny states aren't completely just lost in the sauce, because that wouldn't be entirely fair to them. But considering the fact that most of those small states, really the smallest and the largest states, are usually not all that competitive, it means that there is a large group of people that's just ignored right out the gates. Right, how many New York voters voted for Donald Trump in 2016?
I hear you. Quite a few did, but how many of those same New Yorkers voted for Mark Molinaro for governor? I mean, if you want to say 59 out of the, you know, 60, if you want to say 57 out of the 62 counties voted for Mark Molinaro, then, you know, that doesn't really add up to a hill of beans. But once you say that five counties controls who becomes governor of the People's Republic of New York, that sounds a little disproportionate to some. So I think you can, you know, do you recognize that could be seen both ways at least?
Well, definitely can.
Okay.
I mean, when you look at a map by county of the country, and it's after the 2016 election, it was, what, like 90% red. But the map shows land, and the people don't live evenly distributed across the land. And so they're competing values that definitely both have value to them.
Right.
But you can't have all of one without giving the other shaft.
Which is representative of what you originally talked about in the first piece that you wrote at www.behindenemylinesradio.us, which is that the Electoral College is a compromise between larger population states and smaller population states that was struck back at the founding of the country. But you kind of feel like that has now, the time for that has now passed, right?
I think it has, for several reasons.
All right.
The first being that education is so much more ubiquitous now than it was at the time of the founding. The founders were almost all highly educated lawyers and thinkers, and the average education back then was only like sixth grade amongst other people.
Okay, and that was a limitation.
Everyone goes through high school. Most people get some kind of education beyond that. A lot of people get college degrees, and so they're better equipped to vote in their own interest without having someone do it for them. Because we have to remember, too, that when the Electoral College was instituted, they didn't even necessarily call for a popular vote at all. Yeah, I mean, about half the states used the state legislature to just appoint electors to vote based on whatever they wanted.
Right, and because back then, you know, even back then, the state legislators elected senators as well, and that's just that was the framework. With regards to education, to me, I don't really, and this is going to sound kind of cruel, and feel free to call me out on it if you want. I don't think that a voter's education should have anything to do with how they vote. There are people out there that go out and vote not because they're educated, but because they are, you know, accustomed to doing so for a certain line. I call it the zombie vote. They go out there and they choose, you know, the laundry, the Republican laundry, the Democrat laundry, whatever the case may be. Their vote is no less valid for that reason, though, because that's how they chose to do it. So while education is definitely more accessible to the masses, certainly much more than it was, you know, 200 years ago, do you think that means that the system should change to reflect the increase in average education for the voter? What did the founders think, that people were just stupid?
They may have. I don't recall actually reading that explicitly stated in any of their writings. Not that I've read anyway, but
there's a distrust there.
I mean, a voter is only as good as the information he has upon which to base his vote. And so between the education factor back then being almost non-existent and also the difficulty in disseminating information quickly. I mean, the telegraph wasn't going to be invented for decades after the country was, which meant news could only travel as fast as somebody on horseback. And so for all of the voters in all the far-flung corners of the country, there might be some crucial piece of information like, oh, Aaron Burr turns out to be a traitor, that would definitely have implications for your vote, but wouldn't be available until it was much too late.
An argument that lasts to this day against early voting, I might add. Something may happen later on that, you know, after your vote is cast, that may have changed your mind.
Absolutely.
All right, well, listen, I'm definitely digging the point, and I understand all that.
The last thing I want to talk to you about, we're gonna make this the big segment on the show here. I really enjoy getting down into this wonky stuff. And again, I'm not looking to change your mind. I'm appreciating an argument against me that, you know, is making me think about this. And I'm sure our listeners are as well. Our listeners like to get wonky just as much as anybody else does. Despite what Democrats want you to think, we actually enjoy talking about this sort of stuff in our circles of friends and whatnot. But I want to talk to you about the ideas that states can try to fix this on their own outside of the framework of the federal government. And that is this multi-state compact that you talked about, where states are pledging that when they get to a certain point, I'll let you explain it. Go ahead and explain what this multi-state electoral college compact is.
Okay, so the multi-state compact, the electoral college, is an agreement that a handful of states have signed on to. It's not binding until their combined electoral vote total exceeds 270, which, of course, is the amount needed to elect the president. And what it would do once in effect is every signatory state would pledge their electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote rather than the winner of the popular vote within their state borders, effectively making the electoral college also a national popular vote. So the form would still be there, but the function would be completely altered so that it would, in effect, national popular vote for president.
You know, far be it for me to use the C word on the air, but doesn't that sound like collusion by the states to change the Constitution without amending the Constitution?
You could argue it is, but you could also argue that every state has their own... They're allowed to award their electoral votes to whomever they choose by state law or amendment to their own state constitution. I mean, there are a couple of states that do it weirdly right now. I know Maine and Nebraska have it even more segmented. So they give a winner the popular vote of each congressional district, as well as the two at-large electoral votes for the winner of the state as a whole. And this isn't really all that different. It's the same thing in macrocosm.
Okay, well, let me propose this to you, and I want to get your thoughts on it. Why, if you want to reform the Electoral College, why leave it up to the states at all? Why not just break it down the way that the Congress is broken down, by county? By congressional district. Why can't every congressional district have one electoral vote, and whoever wins that congressional district wins the election? Wouldn't that be the closest to democracy that you can get?
Well, yes and no. It definitely breaks it down to a lower level, which makes it a lot more intimate and really a lot more Jeffersonian than what we have now. But the drawback there is that the district lines shift considerably every time we have a census. And if you've read some of my other pieces on gerrymandering, you might recall that some districts are made incredibly weird shapes in order to include or exclude voting blocks in order to preordain the outcome before it ever happens.
Well, because, this spoils a victory, my friend. The winners write the history.
The winners do, but is that right entirely?
Are you asking me whether I think it's right that the winners get to draw the lines? I don't think...
Right.
I'm of two minds when it comes to gerrymandering. That's a whole other segment, but just as a short answer, I think that there should be some control over those congressional lines. I don't think it should be left up to activist judges, which is what happened in the People's Republic of New York when the legislature was split and they couldn't decide on their own how the line should be drawn. There has to be some better guidelines other than race for drawing those lines. Geography has to definitely come into account. But I think that the winners of the elections should get to draw those lines. Absolutely. I think it is a political process after all, isn't it?
It's a political process, but I'd argue that it shouldn't be made into a spoils system in which the winners get more than they ought. We ought to come up with something that our institutions should be partisanship proof to an extent. And in most states, that's not what we're seeing as far as the gerrymandering issue.
Which means I can fully expect an article from Nat Paul on how primaries are a bad thing. And I think that's coming up in the next article that we're going to be putting out. Right, Nat?
That's right.
All right. Well, listen, this is an interesting, evolving conversation. It's definitely one the country has to have. I'm glad that you brought it to the fore. Do I feel like it's, you know, you have it all worked out? I'm not so sure. I have definite disagreements with you. I can respect where you're coming from. It's a dare I say it's a clinical analysis, not necessarily a political analysis. I think you recognize that, right?
Right.
Which is what you were going for, because you are a wonky little nerd, ain't you?
Yes, sir, I am.
All right. Well, as long as, listen, admitting it is the first step. Seeking help is the next step, and we'll definitely help you out with that. And by the way, tell everybody in the audience what your background is and where you come from. You have an interesting backstory, my friend.
Oh, boy. So I was born in Australia. My parents were Baptist missionaries there, and so I grew up traveling a lot between the U.S. and Australia. Finally moved back to the States permanently about halfway through high school. Lived in Illinois, of all places. After high school, I worked at State Farm for a bit and then ended up joining the Army, the Reserves. And so I served in the Reserves throughout my time in college at the Citadel, the Military College of South Carolina. My plan had been to commission, and then I blew out my knee and my ankle while running, and so that didn't happen. So now I'm still in the Army Reserve, enlisted. I've got my degree in political science with a focus on international politics and military affairs, and a minor in East Asia studies.
So the man's got a big brain. He's got a big, big brain.
I like to think so.
And he's modest, too.
Some people probably like to think not.
You know what I'm thinking right now? You are a mix of me and Russ, because Russ has the military background. We both have big, big brains. And you're fitting right into the fold here, man. We're glad that we have you on board. And we're glad we can knock out this first radio interview with you. Don't worry, you'll get more comfortable with it, and you'll get more comfortable with us talking as we go along. You know that we're a bunch of snarky SOBs. And, you know, feel free to, you know, jump into any conversation you want to in the coming weeks, especially as we head towards Buffoon of the Year and all the fun stuff we're doing here on the show. We're glad you're aboard, Nat. We really are.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure so far. I look forward to many more.
Oh, this was fun, and we're going to continue this conversation for sure off air. But until the next time we have Nat on, and actually it's just about time to close down the show, we're gonna shut this sucker down. I want to thank Nat for coming on the show, for discussing the great work he was putting on. Again, check it out at www.behindthemelinesradio.us. There's a section there for the wonks at the bottom of the page where you'll find all of Nat's stuff. It's basically going to be Nat's corner of the site. You know, he seems to really bring this real academic clinical approach to the website, where me and Russ are just basically monkeys throwing crap in the air. He's really bringing some legitimacy to us. And check him out at the site, www.behindthemelinesradio.us. And until next week, from the People's Republic of New York, Gene Berardelli, Nat Paul, Behind Enemy Lines, we are out of here. Good night, folks.
Our position's been compromised. It's time to roll out. Report for debriefing at www.behindenemylinesradio.us. And look for regular communications via Facebook and Twitter at BEL_radio. You are the resistance. Behind enemy lines. Back in 7 days. Out.